All right. So in Acts 9, verse 31, we pick up the story as Luke records it here. The churches throughout all Judea, Galilee, and Samaria had peace and were edified, walking in the fear of the Lord and the comfort of the Holy Spirit, they were multiplied. So there's a period of stability and growth that goes on here. And the episodes that we are going to talk about, we have the death of one of the saints, a lady by the name of Dorcas or Tabitha. And then we're going to cover the story of the centurion who is converted as Peter goes to him. And that episode in the church right there. But it is kind of a period of building and forming, and there's no major hit on the church. There's not a big attack against it during this time. And that's good. The other day I kind of talked about in our personal life, we were going along, and then we had to have a peak of activity, and then, you settle out for a period of time. The Bible story is like that, and in terms of the church story here in the book of Acts, we're in kind of, we'll enter in this kind of a 10-year period where there's things going on, but Luke just doesn't cover them all, and that's okay. There are times in the church when life goes along in the terms of the church story. The gospel's being preached. People are being fed, nourished. Camps are going on, to look at it in our own time. ABC classes are working well. Students come and go. People grow through the years. The more you can get a period of stability without any major eruption of whatever in terms of our modern story in the church, any length of time is appreciated. But it's during those years without a lot of drama going on that people can make growth. We can learn during a time of peace. Peace is always good. And this is what takes place here. So we'll have one major story, and that is the trip to Caesarea, which we'll talk about. So let's pick it up, verse 32. It came to pass, as Peter went through all the parts of the country, that he also came to the saints who dwelt in Lydda. And this is along the coastal area. If it's shown here, it's down around here. Right there. Okay, there's Lydda and Joppa over here. So we could almost say that he's making a tour among the churches, just visiting congregations, visiting the saints who are in this area, and he came down to Lydda. And in verse 33, he found a certain man named Aeneas who had been bedridden 8 years and was paralyzed. And Peter said to him, "Aeneas, Jesus the Christ heals you. Arise and make your bed." And he rose immediately. And so all who dwelt at Lydda and Sharon saw him and turned to the Lord. And so there was also a certain disciple at Joppa named Tabitha, which is translated Dorcas. In other words, her name was Tabitha, translated into the name Dorcas. And this woman was full of good works and charitable deeds, which she did. All right, so the name Tabitha actually means gazelle, and Dorcas is the Greek version of that name. We're not told exactly why, probably for his audience. Luke gives both names here, but Tabitha means a gazelle. All right, a gazelle's a graceful animal in Africa. You see plenty of those over there. She was full of good works and charitable deeds, but it happened in those days, it says, that she became sick and died. And that when they had washed her, they laid her in an upper room. And since Lydda was near Joppa, then they called for Peter. They heard that Peter was there in Lydda. They sent two men to him, imploring him not to delay in coming to them. Peter arose and went with them. And when he had come, they brought him into the upper room. And all the widows stood by him weeping, showing the tunics and garments which Dorcas had made while she was with them. So she was very handy with her. Obviously, she probably, with the other these other widows that are mourning her death, they probably made a lot of garments and gave them to people. My wife grew up a Mennonite in the Mennonite church in northern Indiana, and the Mennonites had, at that time, they may still do, a little group for young girls in their in the Mennonite church. They called them the Daughters of Dorcas, and they would put, they would knit and do things. My wife can remember knitting hats or scarves or something. And they Mennonites were big missionaries in Africa, Asia, and they would knit and do these things. And the Daughters of Dorcas, then they would be sent with their missionaries in these other parts of the world to give to people. Now, we do a lot of things today, and we've dug wells in Africa. We've done things in Angola and other places around the world, solar cells and things like that through the years. So we have our good works, and Daughters of Dorcas is that. But this is what this woman was all about. And they were laying out the quilts and the towels or clothing or whatever it was that they made, and they were going through a period of mourning with her. Now, keep in mind what Luke is doing. And I've mentioned this, when you put together the Gospel of Luke and the book of Acts, one of the things that you note is that Luke talks a lot about women and the role of women in the church. All right? And he has all of these different individuals. So if you're looking for a story about a woman, where was that story about Dorcas? Well, thank Luke in one of his two books. Or you'll find other references in the Gospel of Luke that the other Gospel writers don't pick up and don't include. Luke does. So Luke mentions women. He also mentions the poor a lot. And he mentions Gentiles because Luke was a Gentile. So he had an affinity for those who were within, let's say, Judaism or even the Roman society, would have been looked upon as outliers, you know, the losers, if you will, or those that were second class, however you want to term it. Luke picks those up and he talks about them. And where they may have been in a different, inferior category in the general world of Judaism, the Greeks and or the Romans, Luke says they have value. And he highlights and he tells their story. And this is what we have here with this woman named Dorcas, that she had a story. And she was known by those around. We would not know about Dorcas. And you know something, maybe even the members up in Jerusalem didn't know Dorcas. But those in her congregation knew Dorcas. You think about the congregations you've come from. And think about the silent, unknown people in your congregation who do things, can be counted on. You know, whatever the life of the congregation, they just serve unnoticed. They may not be a deacon or deaconess or an elder, but they are the ones that are always there, always been there. And they may be known in your congregation, but they may not be known in, you know, across the country. But God knows them, and you know them, and you value them. That's the type of person Dorcas was, all right? And God knows, and he's inspired Luke to record her story. She had compassion for people, and she was able, likely, to gather the other women with these particular skills. We'd call them homemaking skills or handicraft skills. These were the women who would make the cards, handmade get-well cards. Dorcas was this type of person, and they were mourning her, weeping, and going on. So in verse 40, Peter puts them all out, knelt down, and he prayed. And turning to the body, he said, "Tabitha, arise." And she opened her eyes. So Peter performs a miracle here. He is moved by God's Spirit to do this. She saw Peter. She sat up. He gave her his hand, lifted her up. And when he had called the saints and the widows, he presented her alive, and they must have been completely dumbfounded. They had been out of the room while he did this. And it became known throughout all Joppa, and many believed on the Lord. And this was a reason why, one of the big reasons why healings that we see in the scriptures were done. They did call attention to the church and to the work of the gospel, and many were became believers as a result of that. And it's just that you know, Peter had the compassion here to move to extend the life of her. Now, she died in time. We don't know any more about her. Maybe she lived another 5 years, another 10 years, and then she died again, and she was not resurrected. But she was given the grace of an extended life here as a result of Peter being in the vicinity, the disciples sending for him, and bringing him into the room here. A lot of things came together to make this happen. All right, so he stayed many days in Joppa then, it says, with Simon, a tanner, and the chapter comes to a close. So this is a couple of little vignettes of a couple of healings as we focus on the story of Peter, and it ends here with Peter staying with an individual named Simon. And then Luke just kind of throws in, oh yeah, by the way, he's a tanner. Now, you know what a tanner was? Or is? Anybody know? Micah.
Someone who works with animal skins to dry them out, either for leather or even for paper and stuff like that, if they used vellum.
Takes the dead skins of animals. Today we take, the hide off of a cow, buffalo, alligator even, deer, elk, and if you know what you're doing, you can dry that out, tan it with the various chemicals that you would use, and then it would be made into a wallet, a purse, pair of shoes, et cetera, and whatever. So it's still obviously a big a business here. Think about this. Anybody know why this would be unusual for Peter to be living in the home of a tanner for a few days, a week, two weeks, whatever? The scriptures back in Leviticus show that if a person touched a dead animal, they were unclean for certain ceremonially unclean for a period of time to touch a dead animal. And that was a prohibition. Now, there's reasons for that, disease. And then, so there's a physical reason for it. But the ceremonial dealt with the holiness of the code of the priesthood, the tabernacle, and the sacrifices. And there was a prescription by which a person then would become clean again and able to participate in the worship and a relationship with God. And I am taking it, you know, for granted that as Dr. Dunkel takes you through Leviticus, he shows you all that uncleanness and cleanness was about, the holiness code, and how that applies spiritually to us today. But Peter was a Jew, and it would have been unheard of for a Jew, an observant Jew, to have entered into the home of a tanner, because he'd be unclean, all right? And Peter's there. He's there. Now, notice that the tanner lives in Joppa. One of the things that you should understand, I don't know all there is about the whole chemical manufacturing process of taking a hide off of an animal, turning it into a soft, supple piece of leather that you know, we would then like to have and personate out of that, but it involves drying and the chemicals and processes and everything, but it takes a lot of water, and it's a dirty business, all right, and it's smelly. I do know that much, and the reason that this tanner was in Joppa is because he's got water. He's on the ocean, all right, so he'd have enough water to meet the needs, but probably there was fresh water there, but also the salt water aided in all of that. And so Peter staying there, it wouldn't have been the best side of town, and it wouldn't have been the best conditions, because Simon probably had his business near his house, right? Probably on the same property. All right. Now, some of the towns that have developed around the world, especially, but I know in Indianapolis it was this way. I remember reading a story about Indianapolis. They have a dirty little river that runs through Indianapolis called the White River, and it's not a major river. It's but it kind of cuts diagonally through Indianapolis. And in a lot of other big industrial cities, as it grew and developed, industry would build near a river because of water. All right? And if it was a stinky type business, usually it would be on the downward side of the river. And in Indianapolis, it was on the south side. They would have put it on the south side. And the businesses were that faint manufacturing, all the others that, you know, put out, belched out smoke and fumes and noxious odors were on the south side. And the winds coming from the west just kept them going east. And so if you had money and you wanted to buy in a advantageous place, you bought upwind from all of that or away from all of it. And so a lot of it developed to the north. Wherever the town is that you've come from, just kind of look at that geographically. That's the way a lot of towns originally developed. The people with money bought on the hills so they didn't get flooded, or they bought away from where their factories were so they didn't have to live with all of that. But the poor people had to live near that. So Peter didn't he didn't mind staying with Simon, but he had to put up with some smells. And he also didn't, at this point, Peter is, he must know something, that he wasn't unclean by staying with Simon, that he was still holy and could have a relationship with God. And it didn't bother him, even though he was a Jew. Now, that's important to realize. Keep in mind, Peter's gone to Samaria, and he was the one who confronted Simon Magus. But he recognized that these Samaritans were now part of the church. God's Spirit was there. And they probably heard about Philip and the encounter with the Ethiopian eunuch. Now, Peter's with this Simon for a period of time, and he stays with him. And so he must have begun to understand certain things about the ceremonial traditions, but he hasn't moved completely into where he needs to be. God's going to move him there, and that's where we come to the next part of the story as we turn the page into chapter 10. The scene shifts up the road to Caesarea. You can still go to Caesarea today. Caesarea is absolutely gorgeous. On the blue Mediterranean, it was a Roman town. Caesarea, named after Caesar. And it was there that the governor of the entire region had a home. And he had a seaside home. You can stand on the actual ruins of the palace there. There was an amphitheater. There was a hippodrome. So they had games and entertainment and big aqueduct. And so it was kind of a resort Mediterranean area. And a very, very nice area. So this is where there was a man, it says in verse 1, called Cornelius, a centurion of what was called the Italian regiment, a devout man and one who feared God with all of his household, and who gave alms generously to the people and prayed to God always. Now, we have a lot of information packed into this. If you jump over to verse 22 here, just to get another reference to him and his character, they said, Cornelius the centurion, a just man who fears God and has a good reputation among all the nation of the Jews, was divinely instructed by a holy angel to summon you, and he's speaking to Peter, to his house, and to hear words from you. So Cornelius, a centurion, a good man. Now, let's unpack this, what we're being told. This is a Gentile. This is a man who is a soldier. A centurion was a prominent part, an important part of the Roman legion. All right? You should know a little bit about the Roman legion. All right? The way the Roman army was set up, you had legions. You had the first legion, the third legion, the tenth legion. And there were like 14 or 15 different legions within the Roman army. And they were, a legion consisted of about 6,000 soldiers, all right? 6,000 soldiers comprised what was called a Roman legion. When you read about the Roman Empire, it was the legions who advanced the empire and then protected the empire. Very integral part of what the whole story of Rome was. Now, there were subdivisions of what was called a cohort. All right? The second level under the legion is called a cohort. But there were 10 of them within a legion. All right? Which would mean a cohort, each cohort had how many men? Soldiers. 600. All right? So there were 10 times 600. So there were 10 different cohorts. And this would be like the equivalent in our American Army. You would, you know, the World War II, you had the Third Army, the Second Army. They were would have been kind of the biggest part of it, the equivalent to a legion. And then you had regiments within that, and then companies within under that. But roughly equivalent, the numbers varied in the American Army somewhat. But you had 10 cohorts of 600 each. And the next level of division, subdivision, was what they called a century. All right? Guess how many were in a century? 100. All right. So you had 100 men, roughly, and it would vary depending upon the timing and after a battle or, you know, sickness and death and things like that. But technically, a century would be 100 men. And so it would take 6 centuries to make a cohort and 10 centuries to make a legion. And a century then was ruled, was led by a centurion. All right? And it's the centurion then who becomes the romantic figure of so many of the different types of stories that are written about this period of time. It was, if you ever, the old movie, The Robe. Anybody ever see The Robe? It was one of the what they called the sandals in, what did they call those? Back in the 1950s, Hollywood made Ben-Hur, The First Ten Commandments, The Robe. They called them sandals and sword movies because they were all these big characters like Victor Mature and Kirk Douglas Spartacus was made then, Charlton Heston, whom some of you think was Ronald Reagan, and he wasn't. But these were all these big budget movies, Samson and Delilah they made. And The Robe centered upon the centurion who was at the foot of the cross when Christ died, who supposedly got converted. He was played by Richard Burton. So centurion becomes kind of a romantic figure to focus on here. And of course, because of what we've got with Cornelius. Now, the equivalent in an American army, a centurion would probably be that of a captain, over 100 men. All right? Now, in the Roman army, though, the centurion was an interesting character. He would be what we'd call a non-commissioned officer. He would the legion would have been led by the upper crust, a patrician or a member of the Senate or someone who had money. And it was very political, and it wasn't for the poor guy. But at this level of the army, which is where the fighting was either won or lost, with 100 men, and led by a centurion with his shield and the Roman short sword, and led by this man, he made all this work. Because when they would go into battle, a group of 100 men led by a brave, intelligent, capable, adaptable man who had risen to become a centurion was a potent weapon for the Roman legion. A centurion would have probably served for about, typically a centurion became a legionnaire, and he served Rome for 25 years, all right? It was almost, you were a lifer, and you worked your way up. And if you became if you were just a poor slub who became, you know, got drafted into the Roman legion, or you had nothing else to do and you went off to fight, you wanted to go fight in Gaul or Spain or Asia and, you know, win fame and glory, you had nothing else to do and you could fight, you did that. But if you had the abilities and you rose in the ranks, become a centurion, you then had arrived and you would have worked for about 25 years. And typically a centurion's tenure would have ended after 25 years, and if he still was alive, then he might be given a sum of money or 40 acres in Spain or some other part of the empire. It would not have been in Italy because all that was already taken. But if he retired in Spain or up in Gaul, which is France, or some other place, and think times were good and the legion commander was generous, he might be pensioned off and even a plot of land, and he was lucky to be alive. So they were the fierce, capable men to lead 100 men, even in the army today or a legion of Rome. You had to be able to fight, to build a bridge, to lead men, to inspire confidence, to be able to take care of the sick, make sure your men were taken care of, their armaments were up to speed so that they were ready to fight, march, build a city, build the next camp. And a Roman camp was more or less a small city in operation, and do all the work that was done. But they were the key to the success of a Roman legion. Now, we are introduced to this man named Cornelius, and we find that he is called a devout man, who feared God, gave generously to the people, and he prayed to God always. What in the world do we have here? We got a soldier, he's Gentile, and he's looked upon favorably by even the Jews in Caesarea. All right, so what do we know about this man? Well, we know just what we've been told. We also know that he's going to send for Peter, and Peter's going to come, and his house is going to all get baptized. That's what's going to happen in this story. But Luke gives kind of a resume for the guy. He prays. He prays to God. That's big G. He's not praying to Zeus. He's not praying to Apollo, Diana of the Ephesians. He's praying to God. He has attached himself to the Jewish community. Is he circumcised? Probably not. Is he an active duty centurion? What do you think?
I tend to think probably not.
You tend to think probably not. Anybody else have an opinion? Because that's all that it is an opinion. But anybody else want to venture it? He may have been retired. He may have been active duty. We don't know because we are not told. He's labeled in the account as a centurion. Not a retired centurion, not a former centurion, a centurion. Now, it's called over the Italian regiment. Some scholars feel the Italian regiment was kind of a group of specialized fighters, archers maybe, that this was referring to here, but they were a known group. But we find that he has adopted the God of Abraham and the religion of the Jews. It's attractive to him, and he's kind. Not all Romans were kind to Jews. That the fact that, going back to verse 22, that he had a good reputation among all the nation of the Jews tells us that the Jews said he was sincere. And he treated Jews with respect. Again, not all the Romans did. The Romans didn't like the Jews for a lot of reasons. Because at first they weren't Romans, all right? And they didn't, they had these strange ideas. They didn't serve the Roman gods. They worshiped this faceless, nameless, statueless god whose very temple didn't even have an image of it. All right, so that was strange to the Romans. But what really made the Romans hate the Jews was the Jews didn't eat pig. And the Romans ate a lot of pig. They still do. I was watching an Italian cooking show a couple weeks ago on Netflix. Love cooking shows. When I can't find anything else to watch, I watch a cooking show. All right? And they had slaughtered a pig in Italy. And it was a clean pig. Imagine that. It was a pig. The pen the pig was raised in was clean, wasn't sloppy. You know what they fed it? Acorns. Acorns, which is good. Fatten him up. He didn't eat sludge. He didn't eat garbage. The pig ate acorns. The pig had a nice coat, fat, was raised healthily, and they slaughtered the pig, and they had half the pig laid out there, and they were showing where the pancetta comes from, where the ham comes from, where the pork chops come from. and they were slicing off the fat and eating it, and they said it tastes like butter. And I'm watching this, and I'm thinking, well, it looks like it's a clean pig. Raised clean, slaughtered clean. And it's not like a pig got in the back sty, you know. And I thought, that's very interesting. Well, it's, the Italians still like their pig. Now, trust me, I didn't go out and buy pig. I'm not saying that that pig's been made clean. But that's how some of the finer pigs are raised, especially in Italy. But the Jews didn't eat pork, and so the Romans, that just despised them. And so they were treated with derision and despise. But Cornelius rose above his Romanness and his military situation, gave money, maybe to help out to build, put a new roof on a synagogue, or to sponsor some person in some way with his money, and he prayed to God. Now, I'll say other comments about this as we're going to go through the doctrine about military service and war later, before the year ends, and I'll take you through that. We'll come back to that part of the story and how this may or may not, what it may or may not tell us about that particular teaching that we have. Let's just say that, look at what the Scripture tells us here, and that is that Cornelius was a good man, and he was praying. Verse 3 tells us that at the ninth hour of the day, about 3 p.m. in the afternoon, he saw clearly in a vision an angel of God coming and saying to him, Cornelius. And when he observed him, he was afraid, and he said, what is it, Lord? And so he's praying, probably meditating, thinking deeply about God, you know, some part of the law, something maybe that he had heard recently or read, and he sees a vision. He has a vision. How to explain these visions that we see in the Bible and so many different things, a fascinating thing to get diverted on, but I won't do that today, at least here. But he knew that it was God speaking to him. All right? What is it, Lord? And so he said, your prayers and your alms have come up for a memorial before God. Now, we read in Revelation about the prayers of the saints that ascend before the altar of God, the incense that we saw there in Revelation about the prayers that went up before God. Well, Cornelius's prayers were like that at the time, and they have come up for a memorial before God. And he's told, send men to Joppa, send for Simon, whose surname is Peter. He is lodging with Simon, a tanner, whose house is by the sea, and he will tell you what you must do. And so when the angel who spoke to him had departed, Cornelius called two of his household servants and a devout soldier from among those who waited on him continually, so that when he had explained all these things to them, he sent them to Joppa. And so he sends from Caesarea down to the coast road to Joppa to fetch Peter up here. So the scene now shifts in verse 9. To the next day, as they went on their journey and drew near the city, Peter went up to the house up on the housetop to pray about the sixth hour. All right, so he's up there about noon, midday. Sun's right up above everything. We have a question.
Why isn't the Lord capitalized if he knew it was God?
It's a good question. Why don't you look it up, and then next time you or Justin can give me 5 minutes on that. All right? Yeah. So he became very hungry and wanted to eat. But while they made ready, he fell into a trance and saw heaven opened and an object like a great sheet bound at the four corners, descending to him and let down to the earth. In it were all kinds of four-footed animals of the earth, wild beasts, creeping things, and birds of the air. And a voice came to him, rise, Peter, kill and eat. So it's quite a vision that he is given. Peter is absorbed in thought here to get into this trance. At this particular point in time, I wouldn't say that the hunger or the thirst is a part of it. He just is intense in what he is doing, and then God's Spirit is working and moving upon him in this way to show this vision. And keep in mind that it is a vision. It's not a literal thing, but he sees this coming down, and he hears this voice telling him to come to rise and kill, which in his own mind means he's thinking that there's a reality. He's living in this, and maybe it's an early version of a virtual reality, but it is very, very real to him. So Peter said in response, and this is how real it was, "Not so, Lord, for I have never eaten anything common or unclean." I have never eaten anything common or unclean, ceremonially or unclean according to the ritual dietary laws out of Leviticus and Deuteronomy. So in his mind, he's saying he even was very scrupulous as to the preparation of the food, that it was bled, it was killed properly, bled properly according to the details in his mind. And so, but in his own mind at this point, the fact that he's staying at the house of Simon the Tanner doesn't at all bother him. He's not associating that with being unclean. It is in the manner of the dietary laws that he is specifically speaking. So a voice spoke to him again the second time, "What God has cleansed, you must not call common." And this was done three times. And the object was taken up into heaven again. And then we can say then the vision ended. Peter's thinking about it, what it had meant, verse 17, when he then is being summoned because the men who had come for Cornelius stood before the gate, verse 17. And they called and asked whether Simon, whose surname was Peter, was there. And, of course, he was. And verse 19, while Peter thought about the vision. So the vision ends, but Peter's still thinking about it. He's still thinking about it. And he's not quite sure what has happened. The Spirit said to him, "Behold, three men are seeking you. Arise, therefore, go down and go with them, doubting nothing, for I have sent them." Okay? Now, Peter went down to the men who had sent for him from Cornelius, and he said, "I am he of whom you speak. For what reason have you come?" And they said, "Cornelius, the centurion, a just man who fears God." We've read this. He's been sent by him. Verse 23, then, Peter invited them in, and they lodged there. And they stayed overnight, because on the next day, Peter went away with them, and some brethren from Joppa accompanied him. So Peter didn't go by himself. And he sensed perhaps that this was a significant request, and he needed some witnesses. He needed some to go with him, which is always a good principle to take someone along with you to witness, to advise, just to help. The journey itself wasn't a short journey. It would have taken more than a day to go up there, and so make it a party. But there's also the import of what is taking place here. Now, Mariah, your question, I don't mean to just dismiss it. It's a good question, and if you can research that, that would be good to take a few minutes to see what you might find on that. Yes?
I didn't read right before that. It says it was an angel of God.
It was an angel of God, yeah.
So it wasn't actually like necessarily God the Father. He's just stating like it's a person of leadership.
Well, here's the point. Because your question leads into really what it should be understood within the context of everything else in this that we're being told here, and the way Luke writes, because we've already seen some back with the story of Peter or Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch, and we're going to see other references, and that is this thought that comes out here in verse 19. The Spirit said to him, to Peter. All right, go. We've already had an angel of the Lord, as you your question spoke to, and then the request was, well, what is it, Lord? And it's a good question. I would have to do some research on that. I've never really focused in on why not capitalized, et cetera, and what the significance of that is. But the question, it's part of a larger question to consider the relation of the angel of the Lord that we've already read about appearing to Cornelius, the voice here that speaks to Peter, and in his vision, and then the Spirit, Luke says, that urges him to go with these messengers from Cornelius back up to Caesarea. And what is taking place? Because we're going to see later on one of the trips of the Apostle Paul, that the Spirit forbids him to go here and forbids him to go over here. And then Paul gets a vision from a man in Troas to go across the sea into Europe in a vision. But Luke writes it the way he says, the Spirit forbid me. What does that mean? Is it the Holy Spirit? Is it a third part of the Trinity? Or what is it? How do we understand it? As Cornelius has this vision from the angel of the Lord, and then Peter hears a voice, and then the Spirit seeks him, and it's all God. The reality is, it is all God doing this talking, because it is by the what we've learned already is we've talked about the nature of God in the doctrinal study, with what we've seen as we've entered into the study of Acts, and we've talked about the Holy Spirit that came upon the disciples on Pentecost in chapter 2, and the work of the Spirit among the disciples. What is the Spirit? What is the Spirit? It's what?
The power of God. The essence of God.
Essence of God, the power of God. Is it God?
No.
It isn't?
It's not to be worshipped as a God. It is what God
is. I didn't say to worship. I said, is it God? Is God Spirit? Well, I see one nodding their head. Others of you may not know what to do. God is Spirit, and those who worship Him must worship Him. God is
Spirit.
We worship God in spirit and in truth. Yeah, God is Spirit. All right? So we do worship God in spirit. We worship the Spirit. Not the whole, not a third person. We worship God as who is Spirit. We worship Christ, we worship the Father, who are the two members of the Godhead, which is what is the one God, right? And the resurrected Christ comes to us when you're baptized and you have a minister lay hands upon you. The Spirit of God joins with our spirit that we are the children of God. All right? Christ, Paul says in Galatians 2:20, the life I now live, I live by the faith of the Son of God within me. And we could go on and on and on. Christ and the Father, it is the Spirit of God and the Father, it is the Spirit of Christ. It's one Spirit. It's not two, it's one, but it is God. Luke talks about God and the Spirit seamlessly. Seamlessly. And it's God talking to us. We can call it the power of God, but if we look at the Scriptures carefully, it's a bit more than just the power of God. It is God. But there's not as, you know, it's not a, exegetically, you can't kind of just A, B, C, point one, sub point three, point little A, point little B. It doesn't lend itself to that. So I just want to point that out here. God works through His church by the Spirit. And this is what we are reading about. And there's more for us to learn to just kind of step back and look at it and read it and realize how God worked then to understand how He does work and how He continues to work today within the church. Pick it up there Monday, and maybe we can talk a little bit more about that and move through the story.